This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, everybody. Welcome again. It's a new day and a new session in this amazing series, and it's just getting better and better. So we have started a few days ago, and we had very interesting guests. We had Dr. Nisa Islam, the first session, who spoke about Kaula and her story. And then we had Dr. Bilal Ansari, and he spoke about the American Muslim woman who struggled to gain her rights as a Muslim in the prison. And we had, in our last session, Brother Rasul Saifullah, who spoke about Blackness in America. And it was a very fruitful discussion and a deep one. Today we have another honorable and interesting guest, who is Dr. Jonathan Brown. We expect that today's session will be very deep and will open up doors and new opportunities for us to understand better our own history, and to understand as well and to navigate through the relationship between Islam and Muslims, and the whole issue about race and how Islam dealt with this issue. Kim, would you kindly tell us a bit more about Dr. Jonathan Brown?
I certainly will. We're just delighted to have Dr. Jonathan A.C. Brown. He is going to be entering the waiting room in just a moment, but I'm going to go ahead and just start to say his bio before he gets on. He is an American scholar of Islamic studies, and since 2010, he has taught at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, where he holds the Al-Waleed bin Talal Chair of Islamic Civilization. He's authored several books, including Slavery and Islam, Misquoting Muhammad, The Challenges and Choices of Interpreting the Prophet's Legacy, Hadith, Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World, Muhammad, A Very Short Introduction, and The Canonization of Al-Buhari in Muslim. He has also published articles in the fields of Hadith, Islamic law, Salafism, Sufism, and Arabic language. And I'm just so delighted to welcome Dr. Brown. We're getting ready to have him come out of the waiting room. And I'm so delighted because I'm actually reading a book for one of my classes that I'm taking on Hadith, and it's the Muhammad's Legacy in the Medieval and Modern World. And he does a phenomenal job in explaining. So let me get him in. He's probably wondering, what's going on here? We'll let him in here.
Sorry, hey, how's it going? Assalamu alaikum. Let me just, for some reason, when I kind of someone else sends me a link, I get signed in by my kid's name. So I will change.
We figured that.
Get to my name. Here we go.
Perfect. How are you, Dr. Brown?
I'm good. How are you all doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, me too.
Communicating with you. I'm Kim Alston from Smith College's Center for Religious and Spiritual Life. And then, of course, Heba. You see Heba at, she's actually overseas. So I know, Heba, you'll tell him a little bit about where you are and what you do as well.
Yes, assalamu alaikum, Dr. Brown. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be in your presence today. My name is Hibatullah Saleh, and I am the community religion liaison at Smith College. And right now I am zooming from Sweden. So nice to meet you.
Sweden?
Yes.
What are you doing in Sweden?
Well, I live there.
Well, that's a good reason to be there. Yeah, I was just looking at where Smith is. It's one of these things where you're like, boy, I wish I'd been able to go there in person. It looks like a gorgeous area.
Yeah, it is great. Northampton, the Pioneer Valley, Western Massachusetts.
What's that river that it's on? Or like the river that runs through that, and it goes down like all the way to Hartford. And is it Connecticut River.
Yeah, I mean, my son was an environmental studies major, and he just loved the Connecticut River. He was always there. doing different studies. So that's the Connecticut River Basin. But Dr. Brown, we really enjoyed the essay that you wrote. It's very in-depth, very thorough, and it is a great topic. I guess you need to tell us how you came upon this topic, why you decided upon this topic. And the fact is, it does have a very provocative title. It's a much debated topic around the world. And we know that a lot of Black people in particular have asked this question. And I assume that many people have asked it, it doesn't have to just depend on your race. And the question for those that are that want to know, there used to be a show, Inquiring Minds Want to Know. The question is Islam anti-Black?
Are we recording? Should I talk or should we, are we like?
We're recording.
Okay. So, isn't it charming? And this is proof that this is not staged. See, I'm not going off any cues. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thanks for inviting me. I mean, I gotta be honest, this was probably the most nervous I've ever been to talk about something. And I've talked about a lot of controversial stuff over the years, but this is, I think, the thing I'm the most nervous. I actually couldn't sleep last night until about 3 a.m., I think it's really, I mean, obviously it's a stressful topic for a lot of reasons. And then of course there's the fact that, you know, I'm white, which is probably pretty obvious to the people who are watching, in case they're, you know, they're cooking or something, or microwaving something, listening to this while instead of watching. But so, I guess the reason why I picked the topic, or that, you know, I picked that title is because, like, that's really, there's a lot of discussions that go on, like, you know, and, you know, you'll see them amongst, like, you know, in African-American community with, like, different strands of Pan-Africanism. You see it in kind of sort of white nationalist or Western supremacist communities, which are sort of like the two opposite ends of a spectrum, right? But they're both, sometimes you see the same discussions going on, and it's really, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, is Islam kind of inherently committed to slavery? Is Islam foreign to Africa? Is Islam a colonial force in Africa? And like all, the root of all this is this idea of, like, is Islam anti-Black? Like, that's kind of, in a lot of ways, that's the question that is being asked. And so I really just wanted to address it. And I wanted to address it, I mean, first of all, because I'm Muslim and I want to know the answer to this. But more immediately, it was because this last summer, there was this debate, I think it's called the Research Africa listserv for, like, academic kind of studying African and African studies. And there's this debate really just, like, it came about, is there such a thing as Islamic slavery? And then, so people kept, I'm actually not on that list, but people kept forwarding me questions because it dealt specifically with things that I talked about in my book on slavery and Islam. And so I started to look into these specific questions, and then I realized that you couldn't really look into them without answering bigger questions. And then even bigger questions. And then I started getting interested in those bigger questions. And I ended up kind of working to answer my own questions about this topic. And maybe I'll just start out with three kind of little episodes or kind of nuggets and that bring up some of the problems and that I think hopefully in the course of our discussion, we can answer these questions. I feel that there's very good answers for them. But the first is, for example, like Muslims, we'll all always hear about Bilal. So Bilal, the first muezzin in Islam, we hear that he's Ethiopian, he's Black, he's African. We hear about some of the discrimination he was exposed to, both before he was Muslim and then after he became Muslim, whether it's the Quraysh of Mecca, when the Muslims conquer Mecca and Bilal gets up on the Kaaba to do the adhan, like the kind of Quraysh elite who still haven't become Muslim, they're like, they only have this black crow to do the call to prayer, you know? The fact that sometimes it was hard for him to find a wife. And then, okay, so that's one, we people are really familiar with this. But what you don't hear, right, is that Omar bin Khattab's both mother and paternal grandmother were African or Black. Like, it's unclear in Arabic whether they're just like really dark skinned or of African descent. Amr ibn al-As, the famous conqueror of Egypt, was described, his mother was African. He was described as short, squat, and very dark skinned, Black skin. Safwan bin Umayya, a number of other Meccan elites, elite of the Quraysh, would be phenotypically maybe indistinguishable from Bilal. But we never hear about that. So why is that? Like, that was the first question I had. The second question, and this was the one that I got forwarded from that debate on that listserv, was there's this hadith, it's in Sahih Muslim, it's considered to be authentic hadith, where a slave comes to Medina, presumably from outside of Medina, and he basically says, I'm Muslim, and I want to pledge allegiance to the Prophet, and I want to make hijrah, I want to come and live in Medina. And the Prophet says, you know, welcomes him, right? And then the man's owner comes, and we don't know what religion he is, we don't know where he's from. We know he comes, he's looking for his slave, and he comes to the Prophet, and the Prophet's like, oh, I didn't realize he's your slave. And he basically says, okay, I will buy your slave from you with two Black slaves. It doesn't say what race the original slave was. It doesn't say, it just says two Black slaves that you will buy the slave for. Okay. So obviously there you say, wait a second, what's going on here? Why is it that two Black slaves are equal worth one slave of unknown ethnicity or color or whatever? And the third one is, it was an episode that I actually translated this in an appendix in my book on slavery. And it was both really touching, but also I didn't know how to make sense of it. There's this famous scholar and like Sufi kind of very pious Muslim in Basra in the 700s, the mid 700s, his name is Malik bin Dinar. And he, there's a drought in the city. All the pious people of the city are out praying to God to bring rain, and nothing is working. And then this, he describes this like kind of scrawny Black slave he's a scrawny Black guy, right? And he has a pot belly, he's tall as him, and he goes and he just makes this small prayer, and then just water starts pouring down from the sky. It's so much water, everyone's happy. And so Malik bin Dinar and a lot of the other big scholars in the city see this happen, and they follow after, they follow the guy. And they see he goes to the house of this slave trader. And so they wait there all night till the next morning to go in, and they say, we want to look at your slaves. And finally they find that one guy and they say, we want to buy him from you. And the guy's like, oh, okay, well, you know, he doesn't really do much. He's just always praying and crying at night. And okay, but you can have, here's, they take him. And the Black slave is like, why did you buy me? I'm no good at serving creatures, like created beings. Like, I only serve, you know, hint, I only serve the creator. And they said, no, you don't understand. We bought you so that we can be your students. Like, we want to serve you as your disciples. And to end the story, basically their teacher, this Black slave, dies, and he dies in prayer. And then Malik bin Dinar goes up to him and kind of lies him on his back to see what happened to him. He sees that he's dead. And then he describes that the Blackness disappeared from his face, and his face became like the moon. So in this story, you have one aspect, which is just, I mean, it's sort of, when you really think about it, it's kind of incredible, right? The idea that, like, would I, you know, even, oh, I'm Jonathan Brown, I must be a great guy. I think I'm an okay guy, right? I'm moral and everything. So would I go and make myself the student of the lowest person on the social ladder in the United States, right? Would I be willing to do that? Like, these people are willing to go, and that's how much they value piety and barakah and knowledge, and they don't care what form this comes in, what body this comes in, right? So that on one hand, that's really inspirational. On the other hand, there's this description at the end of the blackness disappearing from his face. So like, it's like, wait a second. So then the blackness is bad, right? And so then you're like, wait a second. So even in this story, which seems really inspirational, there's this like kind of seems like an anti-black element. So these are the questions I wanted to answer. And that's why I wrote this thing and why I as a Muslim want to think about it.
So does that mean that you think that a lot of the symbolism are more metaphors for different elements, like from whether piousness or challenge or prejudice?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I got really interested in the course of this research was this idea of, I mean, blackness as metaphor and blackness as literal description, right? So, you know, we can say, you know, we'll say, for example, this piano is black, right? And we'll also say like, oh, it's a black day. He's the black sheep of the family, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. And we assume that this kind of metaphoric and literal use of the term black are kind of always linked in language. So what I found is really interesting is the idea that black is sort of metaphorically bad, dirty, impure, you know, black or dark, right? Black, you know, bad, dirty, impure, unfortunate, and white or light is good, pure, innocent, positive. These are basically universal. It's not in every language, but if you go and you kind of look at the languages that have been studied on this, it's pretty much everywhere in the world. And so here's my question. What about languages in Africa south of the Sahara spoken by people that we at least would kind of identify, would say are like phenotypically black or African? So how does the word black function in their language? And what I found is that if you look at languages like Wolof, Pular, Hausa, what is the other one? Hang on, sorry. I wrote down the other, Jola, Yoruba, Shona, Fulani, Zulu, Zarma, Hausa, Mure, Luau, right? In all these languages, what you see is, well, in almost all of them, right? Well, in all of them, totally normal for someone to say that their skin is black, right? So to say like, oh, you know, his skin is black, that would be completely normal. It wouldn't be a negative thing to say about them. But in all of those languages, either the word black or in one case, the word dark are used metaphorically to say things are bad, like black-hearted, you know, things like that. So this is really interesting because you have situations where people are using the word black to talk about their own skin color and it's not bad at all. And then use the same word to talk about like black-hearted person. And then it's definitely negative. So in a weird way, like anti-blackness is universal, but not in the way we expect, right? So it's present in the language, but not in the way that language is actually talking about skin color. Then the other thing that I thought was insane, which really blew my mind, which is if you look at Scandinavian poetry and kind of epic from between the 900s and the 1300s, and like this one poem called the Rigsula, which dates, we're not sure exactly what it comes from, probably 1000s, 1200s, 1300s. It talks about the origins of the kind of Scandinavian social classes. And it says, you know, the nobles and the farmers, they were born and they were like bright and ruddy and red-haired and blonde-haired. The slaves are born dark. It's depending on the reading of the poem, either it's dark, black-haired or black-skinned. And svartan, like the word that is black. Now, who are the slaves? The word in Scandinavian is thrall, right? Who are the slaves of these people? They're other Scandinavians, or they're like Irish people. And now, I mean, first of all, those people don't look any different from other Scandinavians. And second, there is no universe where these people could be considered anywhere near like a dark-skinned person. I mean, these are the probably the pastiest people in the world. But they're, so what's really interesting is that here the metaphor of the idea of black as kind of low and bad is actually creeping into the way they talk about the physicality of these people, even though the people physically don't look any different from them. So anti-blackness can be present even when there's actually no black people, no people that, and everyone looks exactly the same and they're all super white.
Yeah, because that was a question that I had, the fact that you were talking about Africans and they'll say something about the black skin and then at the same time say something negative about blackness or black hearted. I'm thinking, okay, but that's fine because there are black people able to talk about those things in different ways because they're the same. So
yeah,
that's a little different from what you're saying now about Scandinavians and others that don't have any melanin. So they're not, you know, seen as black, and yet they're talking in that way. And so how does, I just want to understand how the Quran and the Hadith are handling that.
Sorry, I'm just the guy, some guy's at the door and I'm trying to get my wife's attention to go in. You can edit this out. Layla, the guy is here at the door.
We do everything live. They'll see it, understand it. Zoom is what it is.
Excellent. So first of all, I think it's interesting to think about why darkness or blackness is associated with something bad and lightness or whiteness is associated with something good. First of all, and this is just, I've never seen this discussed, but it's my theory. I could be wrong, I could be right, which is that, you know, human beings are like, we're part of nature. And we, you know, when do we do stuff? We do stuff during the day. When do we not do stuff? We do stuff at night. Like, what scares people? Darkness scares people. Not being able to see things scares people, right? So at a really like basic level, the day is good and the night is kind of bad and scary, right? The second thing is really economic. And this is where you see it in the case of the Scandinavian description is people, light skin is attractive and good because it's economically well endowed, right? So what does it mean? People who are attractive when they are, they have a lot of resources, right? Mm-hmm. So in sometimes in places in human history, people who are really fat are super attractive. It's like, wow, look how much food they have. And nowadays it's, wow, that guy's attractive because look how thin he is. He doesn't sit around and eat. He actually goes to Whole Foods. He didn't buy his dinner at 7-Eleven. He has time to exercise. He doesn't work all the time, right, behind a desk. So whatever is kind of economically advantageous is seen as attractive. So for most of human history, who are the people who are rich? They're the people who don't have to go out and work. So if you're inside, you're not in the sun, you're not getting dirty, you're not getting sunburned, you're going to be more attractive, economically attractive, and therefore physically attractive than people who are out like doing the manual labor. And so when you look at the Scandinavian descriptions of the black slave, they're both black and colored, but they're also like dirty, they're sunburned, their hands are like rough. So this idea of blackness and darkness overlaps with being someone who's out in the field all day and working and not doesn't have the luxury of being inside. So the reason why this is important for talking about Islam and anti-blackness is that the Quran very clearly uses this metaphor, right? So it talks about, you know, on the day of judgment, there will be faces that are blackened and faces that are whitened. And, you know, the faces that are whitened are those who believed and did good deeds. These that are blackened are those people who disbelieved and didn't do good deeds, right? It talks about how when people, when the Arabs in the time of the Prophet got news of having a daughter, their faces would be blackened, like with bad news. And kind of, it's obviously criticizing that. Now, it's very important to note that when you look at Muslim scholars talking about this verse, they say very clearly this is not about people's skin color, right? Because first of all, it says that faces are black and are white end on the day of judgment. It's not that there's black and white faces. So that process happens on the day of judgment. It's not about our earthly color. The second thing that's really important is that sort of black white binary in metaphor that the Quran uses to talk about good and bad is not really found amongst the Arabs when they talk about their own skin color. So the Arabs don't talk about black and white during the time of the Prophet and around pre-Islamic and early Islamic times. They talk about, if they're going to talk about two colors, they talk about black and red. So red would be essentially lighter skinned Arabs, and you can think about like Mediterranean and Persian type people. Like Northern European white people were off the map for them. Like they would sometimes call them blue or blonde, you know, ashkar, which means like really ruddy or fair, and sometimes blue, because if you think about, if you're an Arab and you see like an Irish person for the first time, someone who's really, really white, it's almost like you can see their veins through their skin, and it's kind of like a bluish color almost. So they either talk, and so red was kind of light-skinned Arabs and north, and black was most Arabs and then Africans, Indians, etc. Or they talked about three colors. They talked about black, white, and red. Black would be like Africans or people who had very dark skin, including dark-skinned Arabs. Red would be kind of Mediterranean, Northern Mediterranean, sort of light-skinned Syrian, Persian look. And white is in the middle, and white would be kind of medium-toned Arab skin, sort of like a darkish olive color in our world. So what's interesting is you can see in the language of the Quran and the language of the early Muslim community that the black-white metaphor is not even the same language being deployed. It's not the same tool being deployed when you're talking about people's skin color. So that's a really important point to make, is that you don't, when you read these like Quranic or sometimes in Hadith, this notion of black and white as a metaphor, for Americans, we would correctly, in our case, kind of assume that maps onto a whole vocabulary about judging people in society, on a black-white dichotomy, but that's not the case in the Quran or the time of the Prophet. Now, I mentioned before, this question of why do we talk about Bilal being black, but not Umar bin al-Khattab or Amr bin al-As or Safwan bin Umayyah or any of these other people? And that's because, here's another question, right? So why is it that if, Professor Brown, if you're saying that the kind of black and white, good and bad thing doesn't really translate over into skin color description, why are those Quraysh saying, who's this black crow who's giving the adhan? Like they're clearly insulting his blackness. Like, so wait a second, what gives? So here's the thing. You have to understand that in the Arabia, the time of the Prophet, in Arabian society, it doesn't matter what you look like. It matters if you're part of the tribal system or not, if you're inside or outsider. That's the only thing that matters. If you're part of the system, if you're part of like the tribe, especially elite parts of the tribe, you are protected, you're secure, no one can touch you. You're like a made man in the mafia, right? If you're outside that, you live a precarious life. You can be killed, hurt, and no one's gonna help you unless you're like kind of sponsored by a tribe. So who are the ultimate outsiders? Slaves. Slaves are the ultimate outsiders. Now, it's important to remember that Arabia at the time of the Prophet, most slaves, or the largest number of slaves, not necessarily the majority, but the largest group, are other Arabs who've been captured. The next biggest groups would be Ethiopians, and then probably like Byzantines, Arabic speakers or Greek speakers coming from what we would call like kind of the upper Middle East, sort of like, you know, Syria area, Egypt, Anatolia. So what, but one, so in this case, blackness is bad because, not because it's bad in and of itself, because it means you're an outsider, okay? You can't tell that another Arab is a slave because he doesn't look any different from a bunch of other people. But you can tell an Ethiopian person. And so he's like, well, that guy's not from around here. This guy's an outsider. And why don't they say that about Omar ibn al-Khattab, Amr ibn al-As, Safwan ibn Umayyah? Because it would mean nothing. Doesn't matter what color Omar ibn al-Khattab is. It doesn't matter what color Safwan ibn Umayyah is. These guys are Quraysh elites. It doesn't matter. Their status is guaranteed by their father's tribal identity. So when they're picking on Bilal's blackness, they're not picking on him for being black. They're picking on him for being an outsider. And this is another really interesting thing. Bilal had trouble getting married. Guess who had two times as much trouble getting married? If we go by the number of reports of instances of getting rejected, who had double the amount of time trouble getting married than Bilal? Salman al-Farsi, who is Persian, right? Who's also a former slave who's freed just like Bilal, who's also a complete outsider in the tribal society. So it doesn't matter if you're, you know, you could look like Brad Pitt and you'd still have a really hard time getting married because you are an outsider. You have to have, the prophet has to come and vouch for you and say like, no. This system you guys are living in and that you're preaching or that you're upholding is wrong. So that for me was really instructive. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay. So I just would like to highlight what you're saying right now, Dr. Brown, and because as we or most of us know that in our history, in the Muslim history, and specifically during the Prophet's time, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the skin color, as well as the issue about slavery, were not as like loaded topics as they are today. So I am really interested in knowing when and how things take a different turn.
Sorry, I don't know if you can hear, there's like some discussion going on in the house behind me, but I'll try and mute if it gets too loud. But I wanted to say this at the beginning of our talk, and I forgot. What we're talking about is kind of Islam as a religion, right? So as scripture, normative tradition. Look, if you want to talk about anti-blackness globally, anti-blackness in the Muslim community, of course these are huge problems. Like that's a huge. I don't want there to be any ambiguity that I'm saying that there's not really this problem in Islam. We're in the Muslim community. Of course, it's a huge problem. And I do my best to whatever power I have to deal with it or to combat it. But that's a separate topic we can discuss another time. Hang on, let's see what these guys are, they're leaving or not. But okay, so how did this come about? I think oddly, I think the best description of this actually comes from Bernard Lewis, who gets criticized a lot for, you know, being an Orientalist and things like that. But he wrote a book on race and slavery and Islam, and he wrote a couple of articles on this. And some of his ideas I don't think are accurate, but I think he was really right about one thing, which is that this kind of anti-blackness is not anti-Africanness, contempt for African people is not really something that's present in Arabia at the time of the Prophet, and it's not present in the prophetic community, right? When it is, like when the prophet says, like, so to be clear, right, he goes out, when those Meccans say that about Bilal, the verse comes down that says, you know, we created you from one soul, and we made you tribes and nations so that you may come to know each other. And the most pious in the eyes of God, or the best of you in the eyes of God, most noble of you in the eyes of God is the most pious, right? So that the Quran actually comes down and condemns that language. And the prophet mm-hmm. says, then he goes up and gives a speech. And he says that, you know, human beings were all created from Adam, and Adam is created from dirt, right? And he reiterates this in his final sermon at the farewell pilgrimage, when he says that, you know, the Arab has no virtue over the non-Arab, non-Arab has no virtue over the Arab, the red has no virtue over the black has no virtue over the red, except in piety. And he, right. then he says in another, I think, a beautiful hadith, which is that Adam is created, God created Adam from a handful of dirt, and that the colors of people come from that, the different colors of the dirt, right? So it's like the different tones of that dirt are where you get mm-hmm. our different colors. Mm-hmm. But what the Quran and the Prophet are trying to do is they're trying to completely break any link between people's ethnicity, their color, their tribe, mm-hmm. and their value as human beings.
Right.
And there's this really moving, almost like terrifying scene. It's the language, the Prophet's language is so fierce. When the Ansar and the Khazraj start to kind of get in a fight and bring up some of these pre-Islamic tensions they had, and the Prophet comes out and he says, "Hada muntin." Muntin means like putrid. It's just this is disgusting. He came and said, "This is disgusting. Right? This mm-hmm. is unclean." And so there's this effort to break this link between tribe, ethnicity, religion, tribe, ethnicity, background, skin color, and your value as in the eyes of God. But what happens is when the Muslims basically leave Arabia, they go out of Arabia, they conquer the greater Middle Eastern world, the greater Middle East, Iran, Central Asia, North Africa, Spain, right? First of all, slavery during the time of the Prophet had been, it's present throughout Arabia, but Arabia is a very, very poor place. Actually, in a lot of ways, it's similar to kind of England or Britain in the, like before the Viking Age in like the 600s and 700s, where, you know, you go, you do a raid on another village, you grab a few people, they're your slaves. But, you know, there's not like a slave trade. These are just kind of part of life. It's captives. Maybe you buy a slave who's been captured from Ethiopia, but it's not really a big part of life. They end up in charge of the Near Eastern world, which has had a robust and extremely important slavery industry for centuries and centuries and centuries, right? So, like a third, at various points, like a third of the city of Rome is slaves, like the population, a third of them are slaves. So they're crucial for domestic economy, agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. The slave trade, capturing people from areas and bringing them to another place where they can be sold at much higher prices, is a big industry in the kind of Near Eastern world that Muslims are now in charge of. So first of all, there's a complete change in how slavery functions. The second thing is there's a change in how Muslims kind of experience Africanness in a way, right? So the Africans that, I mean, first of all, like the Ethiopians that are present in Arabia at the time of the Prophet and kind of before the Prophet, they're there. Some of them are slaves. Some of them are there as like merchants. I mean, there's instances, you know, in the life of the Prophet where there's delegations of Ethiopians come to Medina. And the Prophet himself often uses words that are Ethiopian words. And he says, like, you know, this is this Ethiopian word. And you can go look in like a Ge'ez dictionary and you can find like basically that same word, right? So Ethiopia is this place across the Red Sea. They respect it, that these people are knowledgeable. That, remember, the Muslims go there as their first place of seeking refuge. And they know that the king there is going to treat them justly, right? So they have, these are not like people that they have contempt for. These are people who are their peers, right? And also culturally familiar to them. Old Ethiopian is basically as different from Arabic as, let's say, Aramaic was, the language that was spoken in Palestine or Syria was from Arabic. So they're like culturally very close to these people. But when their Muslims are now in this bigger world of trade and slave trade and economy, they start coming across Africans being brought from like East Africa, sort of Kenya, Tanzania area, They would call them Zanj. Africans being brought from across the Sahara, from what we think of now as like, say, Chad, Niger, and south of there, up to the to places like Tunis, Cairo, later on becomes Cairo. And these are like people from another universe to them, right? They're not people who are, they're exotic. They're essentially exotic items. The same way that they're getting slaves from India and from Persian lands and from Turkic lands and from Slavic lands, right? So they are like, they start to, it, what you see in Islamic civilization is that slavery is not, well, slavery is racialized, but it's racialized in a lot of different ways. So in America, slavery and blackness and freedom and whiteness are inextricably linked, right? So whiteness is defined as being free and not being black. Being black is defined as below white and enslavable or slave or enslavable, right? So like you cannot, that's why I think it's kind of funny when people talk about like, you know, white nationalists, like we can talk about white culture. I don't think there's a way to talk about white identity in America that's not based on racism. I just don't think it's like, I wish it were possible. I don't think it's possible, but that's not the case in Islamic civilization, because there what you have is slave could be look like anybody, right? Most slaves in Islamic civilization, probably, we don't know exactly, but most are probably Slavic, right? So, which would mean just something from Europe or Turkic. And of course, there's a lot of African slaves as well. But it's there.
I have a question for you about, you mentioned in your essay around the Hadiths and the fact that those that do talk about blackness in a negative way, like saying that the black face is disfigured, or you know, there's the person is stupid or lazy, these negative connotations that we in America are used to in terms of it being racialized specifically in that way. But you say that some of those hadiths are considered forgeries.
Yeah, I mean, they're all forgeries. They're forgeries by definition, right? Because Muslim scholars say that you cannot have a hadith that insults an entire ethnicity. It just doesn't mean it would be the prophet. It's not possible for the prophet to say that, because it's just grotesquely inaccurate, right? So you can't. So when you look at, well, see, well, why do we find these hadiths in hadith books? Well, you don't find them in the main hadith books. You find them in kind of totally uncritical books of hadith. They're just gathering a bunch of material. And you find them in, tragically, in the works of Muslim scholars, you know, where they'll be like, oh, look how smart this guy is. I mean, there's this sort of shameful episode. I don't think it actually happened, first of all. I don't think it occurred, but I'll tell the story, right? So Imam Shafi is allegedly in the mosque. And this kind of African slave or African comes in and sort of lies down and then leaves. And this other guy comes in and he's looking around, and the Shafi says, okay, you're looking for this black slave, right? And he says, he's like, yeah, I am. And he said, he's in jail. Go look in the jail. And then the guy says, how did you, he goes to the jail. He finds him there. He comes back and says, Imam Shafi, how did you know that? He says, well, the prophet said that black Africans, when they're hungry, they steal, and when they're full, they fornicate. So either he's going to steal, he's going to end up in jail. Now, that, first of all, that's not a hadith of the prophet. It's complete forgery, and many, many Muslim scholars have said that. The second thing is, I don't think this story with Imam Shafi actually took place, because our chains of transmission for that story are either terrible or sort of unidentifiable. So I don't think it happened, but here's the problem. It appears in books about like the virtues of Imam Shafi, and like, oh, look how clever he was in the situation. So that, I mean, whatever, you know, I can say with confidence that the prophet didn't say that. I can say with confidence that I don't think Imam Shafi said this, but we know for sure that this is in several books written by prominent Muslim scholars. And the problem is that, you know, anti-black sentiment is is pervasive, right? I mean, it affects people, you know, who are otherwise intelligent and sensible and morally, you know, acute people.
So you're saying that the theology is sound, obviously, because the prophet would not have said that. We know that Allah would not sanction that. And so we have to be able to differentiate between the flaws of individuals and people, and which some unfortunately permeates into society at times, and the Quraysh to present day, we're not exempt. We still have the same flaws.
Yeah, but I think what I always want, I always remind students, or, you know, my Muslim students and Muslims, is that, you know, in Islamic history, sometimes some people have crazy ideas. Sometimes a lot of people have crazy ideas. But there are always voices, and they're usually really authoritative voices. Like, I don't mean some marginal scholar. I mean some like senior respected scholar who is out there calling BS on whatever issue you think of, like whatever problem you have, whatever issue you're concerned about. I can just inductively from my experience say that there is always a voice making that same point, right? And so people were like saying that this, you know, even scholar who's this essentially in the same time period as Imam Shafi, when someone brings up like that kind of hadith to him about the black slave, he says, whoever narrates this, that, you know, they're not reliable. You just discount them immediately, right? So they are very aware, like even things like when we talk about this notion of kafa'a in like marriage or suitable partners for Muslims. And sometimes, you know, Muslim scholars will, in let's say like North Africa or the Middle East, will really go down like some racial, you know, rabbit hole on this stuff, right? So, but not just about African people, but also about white people. So they'll say, you know, that like in Maliki law, you'll see that, you know, one of the things that makes a woman kind of undesirable would be that she's black or dark skinned, but also that she's like a convert, like a Persian or European convert to Islam or something. So it's like you both ways are impugned, right? But or seen as undesirable. But then you'll see big Maliki scholars at the same time saying, no, this stuff is all nonsense. This is all nonsense. The prophet says Muslims, their blood is all equal. Right. So you always have to I don't want to say look for, but I know that you'll always find these voices that are, when one kind of trend starts to go astray, it will be there to call those people out and sort of call them back. And the thing I would say, I want to make sure I mention this before, you know, whenever you guys cut me off, but politely, obviously, I'm not saying you're going to be rude, but you also have stuff to do. So the story of that, the kind of slave saint who dies and then the blackness disappears, I think this is one of the hardest things for us to, I mean, us, I sort of mean like an American audience that's sort of very naturally reading a lot of these things with a sensitivity towards what we know, how we know language is used in our own society, right? So you kind of have to step outside our assumptions and step into the assumptions of someone like Malik bin Dinar. And you can find stories like this in Rumi's Masnavi, lots of Sufi, really wonderful works of great mystics like Rumi or et cetera, et cetera. The same story, a black saint who's just immensely respected for their piety, their like closeness to God. Then something happens and the blackness leaves them, but it's always, it doesn't say they became white. It doesn't say they, you know, look like Max von Sydow in Greatest Story Ever Told or something. He was Swedish, by the way, the late Max von Sydow. It says that his face became like the moon. And here you really have to understand the kind of cosmology and the language that's going on in the Sufi tradition, right? So the goal of the Sufi path is to become close to God, to sort of in a physical sense, to rise out of this world, to rise up towards the heavens, towards the divine. And the symbol of that, the sort of the barrier between our earthly world and the world of reality, is the moon. And that's true. It comes from Neoplatonism, the idea of the sublunary world. Like, the moon is the kind of edge of this world, in a way. And it's also an image of beauty in Arabic poetry. So the Prophet's face is like the moon. Over and over again, you see this in praise poetry by the Prophet. His face is the moon. His face is the sun. His face is the moon. It's like glowing like the moon. And that's both because the moon is beautiful, but also because he is the best of creation, right? He's the closest you can get to the closeness to God. The closest you can be to God is in the station of the Prophet, alayhi salam. So when someone is becoming like the moon, they're not becoming white like, you know, Jonathan Brown or David Bowie or something like that, right? They're becoming they're becoming close to God, right? They're leaving the kind of dirty and messed up earthly world with all its constraints and limitations. And then this is the other thing that's really important. In that language, if you're trying to construct sort of an image of a human being transcending the earthly world and attaining kind of almost enlightenment, right? What stands in for the human being? The black slave, right? Because not only is the black slave seen as the sort of lowest rung on the social ladder, the slave, but, and by the way, right, how does Sufis always talk about human beings? They always talk about them as slaves of God, just like the Quran and the New Testament, the Old Testament talk about human beings, the slaves of God. But this is especially pronounced in the Sufi tradition, where the Sufi wants to be the Muslim who's going above and beyond the regular requirements of the Sharia to attain true closeness to God, is trying to become the most devoted slave of God, right? The one who's freed in becoming a total slave of God, you become free, right? Now, then why blackness? Because what is Adam?
That's my question, why blackness?
Adam, what does Adam mean? Adam means dark, very dark. Udma means very dark or black, right? So Adam is created from dirt. And actually, my kid just asked me this the other day. He's like, why are black people not white? And so that's actually an interesting question, except it should be the other way. It says, why are white people not black? And both kind of, you know, in terms of our kind of sacred narrative of humanity, where, you know, humans come from Adam, right? So Adam is created dark. Like, that is the natural state of man. The natural state of the human being is this dark-skinned creature of the earth. And so when that dark-skinned creature of the earth escapes, like transcends the world of forms and moves towards God, towards the moon, right? That is the story of a saint, of a wali. And then to my kid, I explained also, you know, why is it that, you know, white people's skin is, because a bunch of human beings were like, kept walking north because they were following some woolly mammoth. I don't know what they were doing. They kept walking north. And if you have a lot of melanin in your skin, well, first, you're not going to get sunburned, but if you don't have that much sunlight and you need to synthesize vitamin D, you're not going to be able to do that if you have a lot of melanin in your skin. So sure enough, environmentally, lighter and lighter and lighter until you get, you know, pasty white people. But it's tough. Like when you read that story, it's really hard for us to say, oh, come on, this is just anti-black. I mean, come on, like, give me a break, Professor Brown. You know, stop pushing it. But look, are we saying that this Malik bin Dinar literally went, bought this slave so he could make himself the servant of that slave, mm-hmm. right? So let's give this guy the charity that he's not some kind of callous, biased, racist person who can't see beyond skin color, right? So let's give him that charity. I think he deserves it. But let's also take his language seriously. When he says the blackness left his face and his face became like the moon, let's take that seriously. But he doesn't mean he stopped being like, you know, bad black because black people are bad and ugly and unattractive. It's he stopped being human. he stopped being tied to this world, and his sort of journey towards God was completed.
Well, that seems like a excellent place for us to start to wrap up. I'm going to give Heba the opportunity to do that. And I say, Dr. Brown, this has just been an absolutely intriguing and excellent, I don't want to say conversation, because it's more like an education about some of these different components that a lot of us are not familiar with. So Heba, I'm going to pass it on to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. I am sure that our audience, the students at least, are benefiting or will benefit from this session as much as we did today. It was filled with lots of new information and amazing discussion. So thank you so much. And I really hope that we can have another session in the future with you about this particular topic, because it's very loaded. And I believe there are lots and lots of other topics that intersects with this one that we haven't been like knocking on their doors yet. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to, you know, like you know, anything I study, it's usually because I have these questions, right? So, I mean, for me, this was a lot of it was about kind of trying to answer these questions myself. And so if it's useful for other people, that makes me happy. You know, I also try to be really honest about this stuff and not, you know, not kind of fudge things or cherry pick. So, you know, I think that's important. And I'm always available if you or your students have questions. They can email me and, you know, look up my email. If I don't reply within a few days, just email me again. If I don't reply, email me again. I won't get bothered. It just means that I miss the emails.
Thank you so much. And we'll definitely share your email with students. And we're going to share this also, this asynchronous recording. Students are really excited. We're hoping that they will use the different highlights that come out of these different discussions that we're having and have their own discussion. Mm-hmm. Because there are things that students, like you said, don't fudge, don't not deal with what is really bothering you. Let's get into the history. Let's see, what does the Hadith say? What is the actual religion as opposed to societal biases and you know, racialized issues? There's just a lot that we need to talk about. So.
Wait, sorry. Can I take two more minutes? I'm sorry. I just haven't. I feel like I've been irresponsible because I haven't. Okay. I didn't explain the. And maybe you can like edit this or slice it in or not. I don't know. But the incident where the prophet gave the two black slaves for the one slave. I wanted to explain this because I didn't do it. But the one of the things that's really important to keep in mind is that the way that, especially in the early Islamic period, people. Actually throughout Islamic history, that they thought about slaves was they associated certain ethnicities or backgrounds with certain skills. Now, sometimes this was like very reasonable. So they would associate like young Turkish men with really good riders, like horse riders who knew how to do mounted archery. And so they were like, if you were looking to build like an army or a bodyguard, you would buy one of these, you know, bunch of these guys, right? Sometimes it was just sort of silly stereotypes, like, you know, Greeks are really trustworthy and good accountants. And it's just weird things like that. Some of those are silly, but in the early Islamic period, you see this, it's a practical aspect, right? So Malik in his Muwatta, so he's writing, you know, essentially the third or fourth generation of Muslims. And he talks about how it's okay to trade, you know, buy one Arab slave for two or more Ethiopian slaves or some other group that don't know Arabic and don't know have commercial experience. So it says like one guy who speaks Arabic and has commercial experience, you can trade for two, let's say Ethiopians, but he says Ethiopians who don't speak Arabic and who don't have commercial experience. So you have to think about like the world of the Middle East in the early Islamic period. So where are Muslims oriented? Like they're oriented towards the Mediterranean, Persia, North Africa, right? Kind of Ethiopia and that world is sort of, it's like even Arabia is kind of marginal place by that time for them, right? So they want people who are going to be able to like be your, why one of the reasons people bought slaves is actually to make them commercial agents, have them run your business for you. So go like, I need someone who can speak Arabic, speak Aramaic, speak Persian, who can go out, do a bunch of trading, come back, and like, you know, bring the caravan back to me, right? So that person is going to be more valuable than somebody from Ethiopia who doesn't know Arabic. We have no idea what their background is, you know. So it was, but you see this very clear association of background and like geographic and cultural origin with the skills they have. And it's really interesting that Jahiv, the famous Mu'tazilite and kind of literateur, dies in, I think, 868. He says, you know, people like to make fun of, like, you know, Africans and Indians, and they say they're stupid. And he says, this is nonsense. Like, we know that it's like in India, they have super advanced mathematics. Like, those guys aren't the ones who are being brought to us, right? So is the point he's making is like, don't judge these other cultures by the people that you encounter, because the people that get like captured on the coast of Sindh or inland in like what's now Kenya or something, they might just be some guys like farmers out, you know, farming, and suddenly they get grabbed by raiders or something. Like, they, you know, don't, you know, here you are like an educated person judging these people who are in no way necessarily any representation of the world that they come from. And we know these places have super advanced sciences. Mm-hmm. So it was like it's a very interesting thing to think about, this idea of like why somebody who is one race, quote unquote, is more valuable than another race. It's not necessarily because white people are better than black people or something like that. It's because that there's a lot of other assumptions, sometimes sound assumptions, about what type of skills that person is going to bring. So I'm sorry to like take that last section, but I want to be responsible and to explain that.
Yeah. Well, there's so much to explain, and we really appreciate the fact that, you know, you brought up that point, because I think that even when students listen to this conversation, they're going to have plenty of questions. You know, that's what we do, right? We have to analyze and try to figure it out, make sense of what we already know, and then go and dig deep and learn new information. So, but thank you so much, Dr. Brown, and may Allah bless you.
And you too as well. I was nice talking to you. I hope I get to meet you in person.
Yes, me too. I assimilate them.
I'm sorry, I got you.
So Heba, that was just a phenomenal discussion. So, yes. So much. What do you think? I know we're well over, you know, we told students we were going to be just like half an hour, 45 minutes, but Dr. Brown had so much to give. So we're asking for forgiveness, and we hope that you enjoy this program.
Yes, I did, subhanAllah. And I honestly didn't want it to end, because there are lots and lots of other things that we haven't even touched upon. And they are very important and very crucial to this topic as well. And we can handle this topic, the racial justice topic and race in Islam from different angles. So as he mentioned, so like from what he said, we could definitely just take this whole discussion from the field of linguistics and language, and how language made a huge difference throughout history in like shaping our own understanding of different concepts and different values. That's one angle to take this topic from. There is another angle that has to do with culture and society and sociology. Another aspect we can discuss definitely is as well psychology, and the psychology of the Muslims at the time of the Prophet ﷺ, and the psychology of the Muslims living now at different places, at different societies, and how this weighs in as well. So there are lots and lots of things, but I'm really glad that we had Dr. Brown as one of our guests today.
Yes. So signing off, just know that we have several other sessions in our series. We have been enjoying it. Continue to look for the information on our Center for Religious and Spiritual Life Facebook page, as well as sending it directly to those that are on the Smith campus and throughout. So may Allah bless everyone. We're going to be signing off. Assalamu alaikum.